Hello, podcast listeners. What you're about to listen to is a conversation with me and Jean-Michel Gaudier, who is another YouTuber, interviewer, science fiction writer, and we occasionally will get together and have chats about space and astronomy on his channel, but I like to post the audio of that conversation here on my podcast. So if you want a totally different rundown of news and interesting events that are happening in space quite recently, check it out. And of course, if you are on YouTube and you haven't seen Event Horizon with Jean-Michel Gaudier or just John's channel, you should definitely check it out. All right, enjoy the podcast.
Fraser Cain, welcome back to the program.
Hey, glad to be back.
Fraser, I was planning this interview and we'll get into some of the stuff that I was thinking about, but just today it was announced, you know, an astronomical event that occurred that I've been waiting for us to see for ever since I first heard the theory that a star could directly collapse into a black hole without a supernova. And we seem to have found it in archival data. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this is a star that was seen in Andromeda, the Andromeda Galaxy, back in 2014 with the NEO-WISE spacecraft, which was sort of the second life of the WISE spacecraft, which was this infrared telescope that was doing this survey of the sky. In fact, it's the thing that ruled out the sun having a large binary companion. Like, we know there is not a brown dwarf orbiting around the sun because of the WISE telescope. And then it sort of was getting low on propellant, and they switched it to its sort of secondary life, which they called NEO-WISE, near Earth object WISE. And so it was scanning the sky for asteroids, but it was still doing astronomy. And so in 2014, they were noticing that a star was getting a little bit brighter. And then on subsequent observations, the star was just gone. And that is not what you expect for a fairly large star that is found in another galaxy, that usually there's the kaboom part before you get the star to be actually gone. And this isn't the first time this has happened, that astronomers have seen other examples of stars. Like, we have such surveys of the sky now that they're able to just track all of these stars in the sky and then go, wait a minute, one disappeared there. And so this is starting to give more and more evidence to this idea of direct collapse black holes, or what I like to call an unnova.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so you get this, and so when you think about, like, what is the cause of a supernova? That you have a star that is many times the mass of the sun. It is fusing heavier elements in its core. It is moving its way up the periodic table of elements as it, you know, goes. It turns hydrogen into helium, helium into oxygen into carbon, all the way up. And when it hits iron, then it can no longer pull any energy out of the fusion process. And that causes the internal furnace in the sun to just stop instantly. And then all of the mass that was around this star then collapses inward. And the force, like, in many, it's moving up to 70% the speed of light as it comes together in the center. And then that is what's believed to create the black hole. But then you also get all of this material piling up around this black hole as it's forming, and then it explodes. And that is the supernova. But there has been this idea that, in fact, maybe that is only some of the time, that the other times, the black hole, as it is growing and as it is forming, it can keep up with all of the material that is slamming down internally. And so you would just never see it. There would be a star, and then it would just pop, you know, it'd be like the house in The Simpsons, in the Treehouse of Horrors, that it just sort of curls up into itself and is just gone. And it's in its place is a black hole with the mass of the star.
Without an explosion. And
can you imagine
what that would look like? I mean, it would almost have to be instant. It's just as soon as that event horizon.
It would take a couple of hours. Like, the star, you know, these stars are going to be, say, like, Betelgeuse is like 800 times the volume of the sun. Its radius stretches out beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And so just like the speed of light is going to take you a couple of hours. And so this thing would just be sort of mashing itself and getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it would just be gone.
Oh, absolutely astounding.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, supernovas are amazing anyway, because that fusion, as you're nearing iron, it happens fast.
It does. Yeah, it happens. Like the last, like it's thought that, you know, one of the things that I really love about these sort of supernova is that the neutrinos are seen before the supernova goes off. And neutrinos are moving slower than the speed of light, while the explosion, the radiation coming from the explosion is moving at the speed of light. And so you would expect to see the light from the explosion, and then you'd see the neutrinos. But in fact, it's the reverse. And that's because as the star is sort of collapsing in on itself, all of the energy is getting tied up inside, and it has to be able to get through the layers of the star to be able to make its way out into space. It's the same thing why, you know, you've probably heard that photons generated in the middle of the sun can take like 50,000 or 100,000 years to get out of the sun, because they have to random walk their way from they are absorbed, then they're emitted, then they're absorbed, then they're emitted. And so it takes a while for that light to get out. It takes hours for the light of the supernova to escape the supernova. But the neutrinos are released immediately. They could pass through, you know, a light year of lead without running into anything. So the neutrinos come out right away. They cross the gulf between us and that star. We see the flash of neutrinos, and then we see the flash of the supernova. And in fact, you know, there is now a supernova early warning network where astronomers are waiting for the flash of neutrinos. They can then turn their telescope at the spot where the supernova is going to be and then watch it as it appears, which is great. And so it's believed that, in fact, you might get some kind of more precursor knowledge, that you're going to see maybe different kind of light on the surface of the star, or maybe you're going to detect new neutrinos coming as it's getting close. It could be a few days away, or a few weeks away from it actually fully collapsing down and colliding. But you're exactly right that the final phases of it to go from, I don't know what they are, like calcium or like whatever the final elements, to go into lead, doesn't take thousands of years. It can take days. And
yeah, and for one of them, it was hours.
Yeah.
That star will go right through it, just blast right through that element. And it's just amazing how fast that happens.
Yeah. And so this story of this direct collapse black hole is kind of feeding into another story that I'm sure you have your eye on and the audience is probably familiar with, which is this idea of little red dots, which is one of the objects that the new mysterious objects that James Webb detected when it first became operational. There's an entirely new class of objects that are very peculiar, that they're seen early on in the age of the universe within the first billion years or so. They're incredibly compact. Like they are like the vicinity around a supermassive black hole, or they're like a globular star cluster, right? Like just this, but they're very bright, and they're bright in the infrared, but they lack a lot of the signatures that says like, this is an actively feeding supermassive black hole. Normally you get X-rays coming from these things. So whatever it is, it's incredibly dense and it is not producing X-rays, not producing the kind of signature that you get from a supermassive black hole. And there's another mystery, which is that we're seeing these supermassive black holes that are too massive early on in the age of the universe, that just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, we're seeing black holes that are maybe 15 times more massive than what you would expect if you just had a black hole form. It feasted on as much material as it wanted. It couldn't get that massive. And so now it looks like you can get these direct collapse black holes. And that's the explanation for the little red dots, that you had giant clouds of gas. You had this kind of knot at the center where a star was starting to form, and some process was funneling material and forcing it into the region that allowed it to just skip the star process and go straight to black hole and just start to form this supermassive black hole right from square one early on in the universe. And so, you know, we used to think that you would have these very specific ways that you would get black holes. Like a star has to die and produce a supernova, and that gives you the sign. And now it looks like, nope, there are other ways that you get black holes, and the evidence is starting to build up around us.
Now that will get us into survey telescopes in a moment, but there's one thing, I have a bone to pick with neutrinos. It's not the only thing that you know they're unimpeded by. They also, you know, the fabled perhaps cosmic neutrino background, which means that all of a sudden, the very first moment after the Big Bang becomes visible, just if we could build a detector.
Yes.
And that's the big question mark.
Why do you have bone to pick? This is awesome.
I get to, well, no, just because they're so low energy, they're hard to detect.
Yes. why can't they bring more energy to the game? Yeah,
exactly. You know,
the cosmic microwave background radiation is the farthest that we can see in radiation, because earlier than that, 340,000 years or 370,000 years, the universe was opaque. And so we have no way to be able to see through something that is opaque, but gravitational waves and neutrinos were released earlier than that. And so there should be both a gravitational wave background and a neutrino background from moments after the Big Bang that would, if we could detect it, you're exactly right, we could answer a zillion questions about the early universe. When did the first forces, when did you get the strong force and the weak force separate? When did you get the electromagnetic force separate from the weak force? What is gravity? Maybe all these questions come from observing the neutrino background.
That's an interesting idea that could actually give us the coveted understanding.
Yes.
Of gravity might come from that.
Yeah. And even like detecting the final moments of inflation, and people have been trying to figure out whether this is even possible, but it will probably take neutrino detectors at a scale the likes of which we have never seen. And the same thing with gravitational waves. I did some research into the future of gravitational wave telescopes. And, we've got LISA coming up in 2035, which is three gravitational wave observatories flying in formation in a triangle with the arms that are tens of thousands of kilometers long. And this should detect merging supermassive black holes. And there was this idea that once LISA was built, you could expand it into something called the Big Bang Observer. And you would fly 12 of these LISA satellites in this, is it an isohedron? A 12-sided die. Like you would form this sort of geometric shape. And it would be enough for you to detect these primordial gravitational waves as they were passing by. But I don't even know what the detector is to do neutrinos. I should dig into that. That would be a good story. I'll try and find out.
There's a scientist in the UK that had an idea recently about low energy neutrino detection. And the idea was that instead of trying to detect low energy neutrinos, you ram the detector into the neutrinos.
Right. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. We do have, there is a nuclear option for detecting these neutrinos. So
all you have to do is accelerate a cubic kilometer of ice to close to light speed, and you should be able to detect low energy neutrinos.
I don't see why we can't do that.
It should be easy. Yeah.
Or blow up Pluto and there's your ice. That's one of the more exciting areas for me is that it is possible in principle to have a window before that 370,000 year brick wall,
yep,
the Big Bang. And so it is there, and in two different ways.
We have two more ways to look at it
now. Transients. So this star collapsing directly into a black hole is an example of a very short-term transient phenomenon in astronomy. We haven't been very good at seeing those until now with the Vera Rubin telescope. What is the status of Vera Rubin? Have we started?
Why are you asking me? Oh God, this is the top number one question. And last year when Vera Rubin was in development, I was like, it's going to be at the end of 2025, and now it's like any day now. And now it looks like it's probably still a few months away. So, we're not sure when Vera Rubin will finally come online and it will begin the LSST survey. But it is any month now. Yeah.
I love how they were able to repurpose LSST.
Yes.
It's now the survey instead of the telescope. Yeah.
The legacy of space survey of time, legacy of space times. Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. What we've seen so far though, from that telescope, the test images were spectacular.
Yes. Yeah. So
I'm just unbelievably excited about that observatory, because again, that shows you, it's like taking a movie
Yeah. So what they're doing, right, is they've got this telescope set up in Chile, is going to be taking an image of the night sky, I think every 15 seconds, and then it moves on to another spot. It's got a really wide field of view, several times the size of the moon. And so it gets back to its starting point every 3 days or so. And each one of those observations, it's the largest camera ever made. It is 3+ gigapixels. So it's a gigantic camera. And is very fast. Like this telescope is able to take its images, like I said, in 50, does a 15-second exposure, and then moves on to the next target and just goes click, 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 click. And so if you've ever done any astrophotography and you stack up your images, you take an image and then you take another image and you take another image and then you stack them up and you get the combined light of all of those separate images. And so what they're doing with Vera Rubin is they're doing that combined light of all those separate images. They're just spacing them by 3 days. And so you will get two things. You will get these beautiful, deep, data-rich images that have, where you have added up, say, 1,000 separate exposures of this same spot in the sky, which is much longer than almost any telescope is capturing of any specific place in the sky. But it's doing the whole sky. And then you were also catching things that happened momentarily in between those exposures. And so you take a picture, you come back 3 days later, you take another picture, but maybe a supernova is in that picture now. Then you come back 3 days later and the supernova is still there. And you come back 3 days later, now the supernova is gone. And so you have detected a supernova in that process, or you watch an asteroid moving through the field of view, or you detect one of the stars getting brighter every 700 days. And that tells you that it's a variable star, or maybe it's an exoplanet that is passing in front of it. That this whole idea of time domain astronomy is that you can just, if you stretch out that long exposure process over 10 years, you will get tons of new discoveries. And the amount is crazy. It's going to be reporting, I think, like about 10 times as many asteroids as the rest of the world does combined. Right now we know about 2,500 type 1A supernova, which are, I'm sure you've talked about them many times. They're used as cosmic yardsticks to measure the expansion rate of the universe. Vera Rubin is expected to turn up over 1 million of them. It's going to find exoplanets. It'll probably find Planet 9. It's going to find just so much of what the universe was doing when we weren't looking. And the part that I'm most excited about is that it's just going to find things that we didn't even know were happening, right? Because we just didn't know to look. And so now we'll look and we'll start to catch these things. Like, new types of supernova, new kinds of variable stars.
And it already, believe it or not, there already is science that came from Vera Rubin, and actually several ways, one on the Interstellar Comet 3i Atlas, but also the moment they turned it on, it discovered asteroids. Testing.
I mean, they discovered not only asteroids, they discovered some of the fastest spinning asteroids that had ever been seen, overturning current theories about how fast asteroids are able to spin. Because what they did was they took the same part of the sky and then did a bunch of those long exposure images to test what a full stack would look like. And so when you see those pictures that were taken by Vera Rubin, I forget what the nebula was. There were some images of a nebula, and there's a couple of images of a galaxy. That was sort of simulating what 10 years of running Vera Rubin, taking exposures every 3 days, would look like in the end for one tiny spot in the sky. And now you just take your understanding of that tiny spot in the sky and you just expand it across the entire sky. What would it look like if it did that quality of a picture, but for everywhere?
Yeah, it's absolutely exciting. And it's going to be, the LSST will be probably the most important astronomical survey ever done.
Yes.
Do you agree with that? I think that's going to take it.
Yep. Yeah, and it's crazy to think about the competitors, because we're at this time where we have the DESI survey, the DES survey, the Euclid mission, the upcoming Nancy Grace Roman telescope, and then we've got the arrival of the Square Kilometer Array, the very large, the next generation, very large array. There are just all of these incredible survey telescopes that are coming online to try to answer some of these big picture questions. And astronomy is always going to have telescopes designed for single purpose, that you take control of James Webb, you point it at some star that you're interested in, you gather your data. But we're moving to this world where instead you fire up your database query, you show me all the examples of stars that were moving at, you know, from the appeared and disappeared in Andromeda. And it'll go, oh, here you go. Here are all the stars that disappeared. And then you can search for those precursors and find out if, you know, you can find more of those direct collapse black holes.
I'm sure we're going to see quite a lot, you know, but they were always the theory that they exist, that could happen, was on pretty solid ground physically. Mm-hmm. So it was just something I expected. I expect it any day now.
Yeah. You know. Well, there was another paper that we were reporting on where some astronomers from Tokyo were surprised that they saw a supernova when it should have been a direct collapse black hole. So it's starting to turn, it's starting to flip over where these are the kinds of stars that are expected to just collapse. Those are the kinds of stars that should detonate as visible supernova. And they're so exactly that this is, as you said, sort of moving into much more reality now than speculation.
Now, a very, very different telescope, and you already mentioned it, is the Nancy Grace Roman Telescope, a repurposed spy satellite.
Yes.
That's now going to be a very wide angle, really wide angle space telescope in the same class as Hubble, this same diameter of primary mirror. So tell us about that. And is it safe now? In other words, there was some question about it, you know, being defunded, but is it safe now?
Well, I mean, is anything truly safe? I mean, in this era right now, things seem to change on a dime. Apparently, Canada built a bridge to the US and then maybe we might not own our bridge. I don't know what's going on. So, things can change, but it does appear that, you know, we're so far along now at Nancy Grace Roman that people would have to just be willing to light money on fire at this point. So this telescope, as you exactly said, about 15 years ago, I think, the U.S. Reconnaissance Office reached out to NASA and said, we've got a couple of these Hubble-class mirrors kicking around. Can you use them for anything? And that's unsettling, right?
Expensive.
But the National Reconnaissance Office said, we've got these these telescopes that are as good as the Hubble Space Telescope, and they're not good enough for us anymore. So, you know, we were just going to throw them in the garbage. Do you want one? And NASA said, okay, we'll try and think of some ideas. And so they ended up with this idea for the Nancy Grace Roman, which was going to be this wide angle version of the Hubble Space Telescope. It'd be an infrared telescope, and it would sort of be configured in a way that it would be able to view this much wider field of view than what Hubble is able to do and survey the sky. And that from that, you would be able to, mainly measure and map out the sort of density of the universe at different times in its history. You're essentially trying to map out the influence of dark matter and dark energy on the history of the universe. But in building it, they also put another instrument that I really love, which is a coronagraph. You're familiar with the coronagraph on James Webb. Yes. It has allowed us to be able to see objects that are orbiting very close to stars and be able to detect the presence of the gases in the atmospheres of those worlds. But James Webb was really limited. You know, it's merely able to measure the atmospheres of giant planets orbiting around dim stars or Earth-sized worlds orbiting around, say, the TRAPPIST-1 system, like a red dwarf star. But they wanted to test out a next generation technology with Nancy Grace Roman. And so it has a coronagraph on board that will allow it to detect Jupiter-sized worlds orbiting around sun-like stars. It can't do Earth-sized worlds yet. That will come with the next telescope, which is going to be the Habitable Worlds Observatory. But this is a test bed of that technology. And so in addition to this sort of mapping at the infrared level, it should also be able to detect Jupiters around other stars, around other suns, which is pretty awesome. And we're really far along the process. So they have attached the main mirror, the main telescope, to its sort of sunshade. And the sunshade is also the solar panel system. And then they've put it through a bunch of its tests, its vacuum tests, heat tests. They've got some vibration tests they're going to be doing. And if all goes well, we should see this fly a little over a year from now.
Yeah, it's moving so fast.
Yeah.
So fast now. And other things, like, you know, we can forgive James Webb for only just barely being on the line because that telescope has been unbelievably amazing, successful, and exceeding what we were hoping for, basically. And if we get another bunch of instruments like that, and Vera Rubin's looking like it's going to be one of those, it's a whole new era of astronomy. It's never been like this before. Mm-hmm. And I find it exciting.
Yeah, I mean, the part that I find really exciting is that we have these longstanding mysteries about dark matter and dark energy, and that up until now, the ability to measure with precision hasn't been there because they're hard to see, but you can only really detect them through their gravity. And so you can measure how galaxy clusters clump together. You can measure how light gets distorted as it passes through large fields of dark matter, and it, as if like ripples on a pond. You can measure the echoes of the Big Bang through the baryon acoustic oscillations. So there's all of these measurements that can be made, but they're very subtle and they're very difficult to do. But now we have, like, the cavalry has arrived. We have the Dark Energy Survey, the DESI survey, which I, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, I think. And that was the one that we probably heard. It's like 6 years of data that has now said, well, maybe actually dark energy is evolving over time, that it is not a constant of the universe. So you got the DESI survey, you got Dark Energy Survey, you've got the Euclid mission, the Nancy Grace Roman, Vera Rubin, I'm probably forgetting some others. And so they've all come online, and together they will pin down the effect of dark matter and dark energy to levels of precision we could only have hoped for a long time ago. They might not give us the answer, but at least we'll know what theories we can throw out. And hopefully that which remains is
it'll constrain it down. And that's what the only thing we can do regarding dark energy and dark matter is constrain things down. We'll be able to know what it isn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you hope that some measurement in the lab or some particle collider will generate dark energy or dark matter particles, that we might get a sense of it and then you can tie them together. But it is more likely that dark matter, especially, could be a collection of things that is not one thing. It is, we don't understand gravity as well as we thought we did. There's also a bunch of particles and maybe even black holes and something else, right?
And it's the sky's the limit on dark matter because we know so little. It's so unconstrained. But there, for all we know, the majority of the universe, there could be a dark periodic table.
Yep.
There could be, you know, dark photons, asteroids. Yep. And that's most of the universe. We're the anomaly.
Yeah. So 85% dark matter, 15% us.
Yeah. And now dark energy is really strange, though, because that's driving an accelerated expansion. And that one is a lot harder to wrap your head around because it has to be a form of energy. To do anything, you need energy.
Yeah.
But that's all we've got. Where's it coming from? How is it related to dark matter? Is it related at all? Does it affect dark matter?
Are they tied together? Was one causing the other? Yeah. These are the questions. And you know, that up until now, our observations have just been so rudimentary that all you've got is there seems to be something here, but we don't know what it is. And hopefully, if we come back around 10 years from now, we will have really precise measurements about this thing that we don't know what it is, but at least we know.
What's funny about dark matter, though, is I believe it was Fritz Zwicky in the 1930s that noticed something was wrong with the Coma Cluster. He's like, I don't know what this is, but something's not quite right. And then, of course, Vera Rubin and all that, even Seth Shostak early in his career was involved in discovering
the
effect of dark matter.
It's funny to me when people, like, I'm sure you get this on your video. In fact, I'm sure someone is writing this in the comments right now, that that dark matter is just this fudge that astronomers came up with because they couldn't make the their observations fit their theories. And it's crazy because dark matter is just a series of observations that you described of the Coma cluster. Like anybody can, who has sort of done enough of the research, who understands, can calculate how fast the Coma cluster should be turning based on the amount of stars that are inside of it. And it's turning faster and it should be tearing itself apart, and yet it doesn't. So there must be more mass. Six times as much mass is what's required to make the Coma cluster behave in the way that it does. And so anybody, like anyone who's like stop, person who's typing in the comments right now, go ahead, take a telescope, measure the rotation of the Coma cluster, and you will come to the same conclusion that Fritz Zwicky did in the 1930s, the 40s?
A long 30s, time ago. I think it was 37, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. You will come to the same answer. And then other astronomers have come to the same thing as well. And then there are another three or four independent lines of evidence that get you to the same place. And so so you need to understand that these are real phenomena, and we don't know what they are, which is fine. And I think the problem, of course, is that it's just that the name is dark matter. And so people are saying, well, because you said it's dark matter, then that has to be matter. But it doesn't have to be matter. All that this is that astronomers have made calculations and the universe is not obeying the calculations. And so either the calculations are wrong, but they've done a lot of work to make sure the calculations are right, and they're right in every single other way. You know, you can measure how fast an apple falls to astounding precision. You know, there's not a six times disparity about the how quickly the apple is falling. And that if you made those same observations, you would come to the same conclusion. So it could be that the calculations are wrong. Could be that the models are wrong. It could be that gravity doesn't work the way we thought it did, or it could be that there is matter, and that is all collected under this term dark matter. So don't get too hung up on the name dark matter. It might not be matter.
It might just be something so simple as we don't understand gravity.
Yeah, we don't understand gravity. That is also dark matter. Like the explanation for dark matter is that we don't understand gravity. And if you go to any astronomer and you say, you know, here's the calculation for gravity that's going to work, punch that in, and the astronomer go like, oh, you're right. Okay. Dark matter turned out to be, we didn't understand gravity.
Well, that's just it. And dark, as you said, as you pointed out, and I'll reiterate, dark matter is an observation. It is not a theory.
Yeah.
It's a collection of something we see. But there are theories as to what it is, probably most famously the WIMP, you know, weakly interacting
massive particle.
The thing is that even then you've got something indicating that that's possible. And it's the neutrino again, because it is a WIMP.
Basically. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and a neutrino is, you know, we detect them in our detectors. We know that you have hundreds of billions of them streaming through your body right now. Right. So if you want to have a particle that is really super hard to detect, the neutrino is your example. Like that is not such a leap, because we know they're there. We detect them, that they were predicted by the fusion reactions in the sun, and they were discovered. And so that is a chain of events, and to have something that is that omnipresent and yet is that hard, that subtle and difficult to detect is not new. And so there could be more particles. The only difference between WIMPs and neutrinos is that neutrinos move fast while WIMPs move slowly. Like whatever dark matter is, it can't be moving as fast as neutrinos.
Yeah. I always loved the neutrino detectors, because they always look like they belong in a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
As like the lair of the villain. You know, like one of them is like underneath the Mediterranean Sea, and the other one's at the ice underneath the Antarctic.
Well, the Japanese one, right, where people on a rowboat in this sort of spherical detector with all of these scintillation of detectors all around them. Yeah, it's awesome.
And there's even... above that is one of the spookiest things in nature to me is the Cherenkov light, and that's what we're looking for. You know, just that blue glow of exceeding the speed of light in a medium like water.
Yeah. I mean, this is a whole other rabbit hole, but you know, the way we can detect cosmic rays are blocked by the atmosphere.
Yeah.
gladly. Thank you, atmosphere.
Absolutely.
But as the particles smash into the atmosphere, and they break up into this spray of other particles, and the particles are going so fast that normally they would decay before they hit the ground. But because they are experiencing relativistic time dilation, they last longer than they should, long enough to reach the ground and to be detected by our detectors.
I know. I love it. It's a proof of relativity.
Bananas.
It's where crazy. You wouldn't even think it, but there it is.
You know?
And thanks, I also,
to time dilation, we can detect these particles.
Another funny thing about that is, I was a guest that I had spoken to a couple of weeks ago. She's a philosopher of science, and she's interested in the history of anomalies, and Carol Cleland. And she brought it to my attention, and I remembered this, that they actually were seeing general relativity in the orbit of Mercury, and they were trying to make up a planet to account for what Vulcan. Was, but yeah. it was, they were seeing general relativity. They didn't know it.
Yeah. And I mean, that is the most beautiful example of a scientific theory. And you know, we're all such big fans of Einstein, and it is because you come up with a new theory. The theory has to explain all of the current observations, right? Why do apples fall out of a tree the way Newton, why is the moon in orbit around the Earth? You know, Newton figured all this out. So it has to explain all that. But then it has to explain the mysteries, like the fact that the orbit of Mercury is off from where it should be. And that's because it's frame dragging, like the sun is twisting space-time around it as it's turning, and that is causing Mercury to be sort of pulled in a way that it shouldn't, or that you wouldn't expect. And then it has to make predictions that you could then go out and test those predictions. And so we get gravitational waves and time dilation and all of these predictions. And it's incredible now that many of Einstein's predictions for general relativity were tested and found to be correct. And yet there are still tests remaining that have yet to be done, that we're still waiting for better instruments and better missions and better ideas to finally test out all of Einstein's predictions, even though they were made more than 100 years ago.
But there's mysteries there too, though, because there are certain areas where GR just breaks down and starts spitting out infinities, you know, like, for example, inside the event horizon of a black hole, or also in quantum mechanics, you see it sort of break down as well. It stops predicting right. And
yeah. So we've still got lots of, you know, if people want to solve mysteries in the universe, there's lots to do.
It's the same problem as Newtonian dynamics was, you know, we knew that there was something, the evidence started mounting that there was something screwy with it and that it was incomplete. It wasn't wrong. It was incomplete.
Just incomplete.
And now we're seeing the same thing with general relativity. It appears that it's incomplete.
Well, I mean, Einstein knew and went to his grave trying to make quantum mechanics and general relativity and gravity talk to each other.
Do you think that we're ever going to find, or do you think we even need, because that's a point of debate as well, a quantum theory of gravity?
I'm just a journalist, man.
Well, I'm not even that.
You are. You're a journalist.
Okay.
You're doing journalism. You were
interviewing. I am journaling.
Scientist.
I am documenting. I am documenting the astronomical luminaries of our time.
That is journalism, dude.
That was actually one of the main motivations of this, was to get some of these people in interviews, because I was never able to find enough interviews of Albert Einstein.
Right.
There's only a few.
Yeah.
And they're
Let's get these people talking now. Yeah.
Let's get these people talking now. And and I love doing that.
Yeah. Course. It is amazing that I get to talk to the people that I do. You know, I've interviewed several Nobel Prize winners, people who were right there designing some of the best missions. I've talked to all of the minds behind James Webb, the designer of the LISA instrument, people behind so many of the other telescopes and theories and all that. It's great. Yeah. 100%. Dude, you're a journalist. Don't.
Well, there was also, you know what? I got a couple of important ones, because I was the last interview that Patricia Van Strett had given, and she was the principal scientist on the labeled release experiment.
Right.
And I caught her just before she passed away. Wow. And I'm glad I did that, because, you know, I am, I am very intrigued by that experiment,
even
more so now than I ever was. What's your view on labeled release? Do you think that we need to redo that?
Well, of course, but I mean, again, just a journalist. So, you know, this is like, I'm seeing this theme from a lot of the people that I'm talking to, right? Like 20 years ago, 50 years ago, we had these simplified ideas about what it's going to take to find life beyond Earth, that we just point a telescope at the atmosphere of an exoplanet. We detect the presence of oxygen and boom, we know there's life there. That how do you get lots of oxygen in the atmosphere without cyanobacteria that's producing it? And now it really looks like every method of producing things like oxygen, ozone, pretty much any chemical except for chlorofluorocarbons, there isn't a way that just volcanoes can belch this out and you don't need life, and that it's becoming a much more subtle thing. And so I think the problem with the labeled release experiment is that it had uncertainty and inconclusive results just baked into the way they were going about it. And so what do you know? Biologists, astrobiologists have been arguing about it for almost 50 years. This is what you get. And so I think that just in general, when I talk to the scientists, the method that NASA and ESA are going about to study Mars and search for evidence of life on Mars, follow the water, search for the conditions, bring samples back home. Remember the Mars sample return mission? That is the label release. You bring those samples from Mars, you bring them back home, you put them in the greatest laboratories that have ever been created, and you will get the answers that you require, which is why it's so sad that it looks like the Mars sample return mission is not going to happen from NASA. The Chinese are going to do it, but not NASA.
I don't care who goes and picks
up. Yeah, I don't care who goes. Yeah, yeah.
I don't care. And the fact is that got way more intriguing with those sort of structures in you know, the rocks recently that really, really look like things life does on Earth.
Yeah, the scientists have ruled out every non-life way of making those. And all that remains in their mind so far is life. But that does not confirm that it's life. It just means that they ran out of good ideas. Now they're into the crappy ideas or life.
Yeah, and this is where science gets interesting, because the theories and hypotheses will swing further and further out there to try to explain this. We saw that with Oumuamua, as you recall. The theories were getting wilder and wilder, involving things that we had never seen in nature before, you know, hydrogen icebergs and all those sorts of things.
Solar sails.
And also, I mean, everybody sort of settled on this nitrogen iceberg idea, but I think there are physical problems with that. Lifting an entire sheet of ice in an impact off, you know, a Pluto-sized minor planet, it's asking a lot, you know, for that to survive that. Mm. So
yeah.
I don't
know. I mean, we went through it all over again with 3i Atlas.
Well, less so. 3i Atlas, to me, it looked like a comet. And
yeah.
What I wanted to know is the more important question in my brain. What is it made of? What is different about the composition of that comet in comparison to the solar system's comets? Because that is like 3 billion years older.
Yeah.
From a completely different star system, you know?
So you know that we could catch both of them still.
We still can. Yeah.
Yeah. That there was a paper that we were reporting on, and it's the same people. It's Project Lyra, people from the Interstellar Foundation, are constantly saying, hey, remember, if you want to learn more about Oumuamua and 3i Atlas, you still can. And that is that you send a spacecraft on an Olberth maneuver around the sun. You get a slingshot. It doesn't send you back in time the way it did for Star Trek IV.
No, you need a bird of prey, a Klingon bird.
Right. Yeah. 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 And, you know, you need some whales to save, but it does get you going very, very fast. You follow that up with a gravitational slingshot around Jupiter, and you are going faster than 3i Atlas will. And you launch by 2035, which is the perfect lineup between the sun, the Earth, and Jupiter. And you catch up to 3i Atlas in 50 years. So 2085, we could have some close-up images of 3i Atlas if the will is there and people move quickly.
Well, the saving grace here is is the LSST, because that will just discover tons and tons.
Yeah. Probably 12 a year.
Yeah. And, something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. And the European Space Agency is launching their Comet Interceptor mission, probably 2028, 2029. It's going to go to the L2 Lagrange point, loiter, and wait for a target. And when it does, fire its rockets and do a flyby of an interesting object.
That's I think that'd be the more fruitful way to do it, because we're going to see, I mean, 3i Atlas, we're going to see a bunch of those.
Yeah.
You know, and you could argue we've already seen one, Borisov, you know. So we will see a bunch of those types. But what I want is a profile of comet composition going back earlier in the universe
history. Yeah.
And see what the differences are geologically
speaking. I mean, like, the universe is throwing samples of star systems at us.
It is its own sample return.
Yeah.
We don't even need to travel interstellar space now, because it's coming to us.
Yeah. We just wait and we just collect every interstellar object and we slowly build up a map of the formation history of the star systems in the Milky Way.
What I want to know, Fraser, and this is a burning question, I've been searching up and down, left and right, through all the literature, and I have it all regarding our meteorite collections. And if anything is isotopically off, that means that we have an interstellar meteorite. Now, I know about the samples that Dr. Loeb retrieved and all that, and that's questions. But what I want is a chondrite or a carbonaceous chondrite. From another star system, and I can't find anything out of the ordinary compositionally on any of the thousands of meteorites we found. They all are solar system.
No, I mean, you've got grains in existing meteorites, pre-solar grains that came from before the solar system formed, but there has never been an interstellar meteorite. That every meteorite ever sampled, they all came from the solar system. They all formed at the same time. They have to be here. Right.
They have to be here. It's just that
somewhere.
We haven't found them.
Yeah.
But you have to remember too that meteorites weather, and you know, we don't.
Yep.
I was particularly interested in Antarctic meteorites because it just sits there, you know, conveyor belts these things and just conveniently deposits them at the end of the glacier for the scientists to pick up.
Yeah.
I found nothing.
So I think that we'll find it on our rooftops. So, you know, there are 100 tons of space dust that's landing on planet Earth every day. It's sort of making its way down to the surface, and it is collecting on our roofs. So we just need a way to grab all of the meteorites off of the roof of some old church, grind it up into this paste, and find out if there's any lead isotopes that are older than the age of the solar system.
There's a guy that specializes in that. I'm actually working on interviewing him.
I've done some interviews on that. I've got a book behind me about it. I would love to get into that hobby of sampling meteorites. But
do you remember way back in the day, Sky and Telescope, I believe it was, or Astronomy, one of the two magazines back in the day, had published, people were taking pie pans of water and sticking them on their roof.
Yeah.
And then going with a magnet and pulling out the micrometeoroids.
That's what you do. So if you have a roof that is old, there's a lot of debris has made its way down off the roof, and you just go along the roof with a magnet, you will pick up metallic particles. Most of them are going to be pollution from coal plants and things like that, but some of them are going to be meteorites. You look at them under the microscope, and they will look different. And then people have independently sampled these things, and some of them are indeed of interplanetary origin.
Yeah, I think that's you're probably right there. It just always seems strange to me though that there is no anomalies. There are anomalies in the meteorite collections, but they don't relate to interstellar objects. Rather, there's one in particular that might be a chunk of Theia.
Yep,
because it's isotopically very similar to Earth and the moon system, but not quite exactly. And it's like, this could have been a piece that was blasted off Theia before the great impact that formed the moon. There's also, you know, a suspected meteorite from Mercury, which is very hard to get out here.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that. That's
there actually is one, though. It's suspected.
None from Venus.
Nothing from Venus. Certainly from the asteroid Vesta. They've nailed that.
Mars.
And Mars, of course. And but those are unambiguous, you know, because you get with the Mars meteorites, especially the basaltic ones, you have samples of the Martian atmosphere inside bubbles in those. And so they go and they look at the composition of that and it's identical to Mars. And I'm like, well, you know what? What if we get a really ancient one and the composition is showing oxygen or something weird like that? Well, with Mars, it would show oxygen, though, because of the rust, you know, the oxidation. But it had some native. Well, so did Earth. But they, yeah, so there's just interesting things hidden within the meteorite world, but not interstellar. And that's the one thing that it then
they have to be here. They're somewhere on Earth. And the problem is that they just look like rocks.
Well, the other thing is, wouldn't you expect if you had a, all right, so, you know, we condense out of a supernova cloud, right? And so we have these chondrules that all form and, you know, that create, you know, conglomerates, creates meteorites. Well, can that be different? Can supernovas do different things? And could you look at the chondrules that are present in an interstellar meteorite and say, all right, well, this is that pre-solar disk, you know, was compositionally different. But then you've got variations in the composition across disks anyway. So it just seems to me that that's a brand new area. And I would have never imagined an interstellar object coming through in the 90s, you know. When I was sitting there watching Hail Bob or, you know, the you know, Jupiter getting smacked with the comet, I would have never thought that, you know, that this would be possible.
There are probably tens of thousands in the solar system right now.